Are you easily distracted? We live in a world that is filled with distractions, the television, the radio, but I don't think there's any distraction in our society greater than the cell phone. My guess is most of you have been distracted at some point by your cell phone, but I was reading a few weeks ago of a lady in northern Greece that was on a bus deep in conversation. When she got to her stop, she got up and walked off the bus. Problem was, sitting next to her was her 4-month-old son. She instantly remembered that she had forgotten the son, jumped in a cab, and chased the bus for the next 20 minutes till it finally caught up at the station. And the son was fine, but a little shaken that mom had forgotten him. But I think maybe you can relate. If you can, I think maybe the biggest place where the cell phone is a distraction is in the car. In fact, in 2010, Iowa, as a state, passed a law in which it is now against the law to text and drive. Why? Because most of the studies have suggested that texting and driving is incredibly dangerous. Some 23% of all car accidents in 2011 were a result of someone texting. That's about 1.3 million crashes a year. In fact, maybe you've heard the PSA that the average text takes a minimum of 5 seconds. If you're traveling 55 miles an hour, that means you've traveled an entire football field before you look back at the road. I'm not exactly sure how they came to this conclusion, but you're 23 times more likely to have a car accident if you're texting. That's compared to just about 2 times if you're dialing, 1.2 if you're talking with someone, and 1.4 if you're reaching for a device. But despite all of the information, 77% of young adults, teenagers, think that they can text and drive. 55% think they can do it well. I came across the video on YouTube, and there's no volume because everybody's talking Dutch, and I don't think you'll understand it any better than I did, but the state decided to set up this test. They are on a closed track, and the instructor tells the students that in order to get their driver's license, they're going to have to adequately text and drive. While they're driving, he's giving them information, and they're supposed to be punching it in on their cell phone. It's a 4-minute video. I won't show the entire video. It is both hilarious and terrifying. In fact, as they go on throughout the video, the gentleman is going to have a rather interesting time as they run over cones, and he asks what would have happened if that had been a child. They're going to go off the road. In fact, at the very end, one of the students is going to look at him and say, "If I had to do this, I would never drive because people are going to die." The reality is that distractions are a part of life. But may I suggest, as bad as texting and driving is, there's a distraction that's even worse. That's being distracted from our service to Christ. Would you have your Bibles, if you turn back with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. As we've been looking at this extended passage, really beginning in chapter 5, the Apostle Paul turns to the subject of sex. And in chapters 5 and 6, he lays out an argument of the dangers of sexual activity outside of marriage. As he comes to chapter 7, he turns to the subject of marriage. And he begins to examine, is marriage good? Is marriage something all of us should participate in? And I must admit, the passage we looked at last week, when he talks about singleness, and Paul is actually going to argue that it is better to remain single, I struggled with a little bit. But I think in order to understand where Paul is coming from, we need to understand verse 35, in which Paul is going to say, "I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord." I guess my question for all of us this morning is, are you distracted? Let me just read verses 25 down to verse 35 of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, in which the Apostle Paul writes these words. "Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for you to remain as you are. Are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Do not look for a wife. But if you do marry, you've not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life. I want to spare you this. What I mean, brothers, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they had none. Those who mourn as if they did not. those who are happy as if they were not, those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep, those who use the things of this world as if not engrossed in them. For this world in its present form is passing away. I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affair, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or a virgin is concerned about the Lord's affair. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. The Apostle Paul is going to encourage us to learn what it means to live a life that is completely and utterly devoted to Christ. I think in order to understand what he's saying, you need to understand the context. And we spent a fair amount of time on this last week, so I don't want to spend too much time, but I think it is important to try and understand from what Paul is writing, from what other circumstances that he's writing. He begins by talking about this crisis. Unfortunately, he doesn't share with us what the crisis was. I think it's pretty clear that the Corinthians would have known what the crisis is, but we can't say for certain. But what I can say is that word crisis is a word that isn't used often in the New Testament, but almost every time it is, it's used in very dire consequences. You go to the Gospels, and Jesus is going to use it as he's talking about those days that precede his return to set up the millennial kingdom. I would suggest he's talking about the tribulation when he says, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written. How dreadful it will be in those days. For the pregnant women and nursing mothers, there will be great distress. There's the very same word. In the land and the wrath against the people, they will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Jesus is describing a time of intense persecution. We in 21st century America have a hard time understanding what persecution really is like. But Paul was writing in a day in which Nero had just recently taken the throne, and Nero, wanting to rebuild the city of Rome in his own image, burns the city, and he needs an enemy to blame it on. And so he chooses the Christians. And for nearly the next 300 years, if you follow Christ, you expect to die for Christ. That is the day that Paul is writing. A day of intense persecution when standing for Christ meant most likely you were going to at least be imprisoned, if not lose your head. But Paul says not only is this the crisis, but there is the brevity of life. He says in verse 29, brothers, what I mean is that time is short. Some would suggest he's talking about the return of Christ, and that certainly is possible. But I think that perhaps what he has in mind is the brevity of your life. Jason was sharing that he's been going through in Awana Council time, the Bible, and he came to the Lord's Supper, and I want to encourage you, next Sunday, I feel like I'm now a television program, the commercial right here. Next week, we're going to leave Corinthians for a couple weeks and go to the story of Easter, and we're going to look at what I would argue is the First Supper, not the Last Supper. But Jason was talking about it, and he was sharing how that as Jesus knew his days were short, he acted in a certain way. He was talking to third to sixth graders, and one of the young men, I believe he's in third grade, raised his hand and said, Jason, we were talking about Jeff Wade. For those of you who don't know, Jeff Wade grew up in church. He attended here for Awana Youth, brought his nieces and nephews, and about a month ago received the diagnosis that he has incurable abdominal cancer. And his time most likely isn't very long. But the young man said, we were talking about Jeff, and Jeff realizes he has a short time, and thus he has to use every minute wisely. That's a third grader. Have I figured that out? Some of you are still graduating from high school or college, and we'll let those people go. If you pull your driver's license out and look at it, and it tells you when you were born, can you really believe that much time has passed? Can you really believe that you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s? It doesn't seem possible. Time on this planet goes so fast. And then we're gone. Are we using every moment wisely? Paul says not only is there this crisis and this brevity, but the reality is that everything you see is passing away. Paul began the service saying that after the service, we're going to have a fellowship meal. There's very simple sandwiches and ice cream. Everything is provided. You don't need to have brought anything. It's all there. But he's going to share some pictures from his time in Israel. And if you go to Israel, you'll find nearly every place you go, there's some commemoration of a biblical event. They tell you, you get to walk where Jesus walked, but as you walk through the old city of Jerusalem, you come to a place where there's kind of a manhole cover. And you look down and it's about 15 feet below you is actually the street where Jesus walked. See, Jerusalem has been destroyed and rebuilt so many times, you're not actually walking where Jesus walked because it's actually 5, 10, 15 feet under rubble. Because that's the way life works. You can follow Paul on his missionary journeys. You can go to the city of Corinth today and you know what you'll see of first century Corinth? A few stones that are kind of in the same place they were. But what do you think will be around from Victor? 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years from now? Will there even be any hint that Victor even existed 1,000 years from now if Christ should tarry? See, the reality is everything that we consider so valuable is passing away. That new car you bought just a couple years ago already needs to be replaced. The house that you spent so much time and energy picking out is needing to be remodeled. Your body that once went for hours without having to stop now goes a few minutes before you need to take a break. The reality is everything we see is passing away. And thus, Paul is going to say, you and I need to learn to live with undistracted devotion. What does that mean? Well, Paul is going to share with us at least five possible distractions in some rather interesting statements. The first one is, from now on, those who have wives should live as if they have none. What is Paul meaning? Is Paul suggesting that I should pretend like I'm not married and pay no attention to my wife or family and just live as I think best without regard to them? Well, if you read the New Testament, it's pretty clear that Paul calls all husbands to love their wives as Christ loved the church, to give himself for it. We have a responsibility. In fact, just a few verses earlier, Paul is going to make the comment that husbands have a responsibility to provide the needs of their wife and wives their husbands. It isn't that Paul is saying we should just give up on our marriage. I think the best way I can explain it is to go to the teaching of Jesus. In Luke chapter 14, Jesus is going to make this statement. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sister, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. What is Jesus suggesting? Well, you need to understand that the word hate is a comparative word. And what Jesus' point is that your passion for Christ, your passion for the Father must be so intense that by comparison, all other relationships take second fiddle. Jesus lived that way. We don't have the time to go back and to look at this story in Mark fully, but in Mark chapter 3, there's this fascinating story in which Jesus is in the house. Evidently, it was Peter's home, and he was there, and people began to gather, and his disciples were not even able to eat. And so his mother, his brothers came. It's translated in the NIV to take charge. It could have been translated to arrest him. They've concluded that Jesus has lost his mind. If you go back and you fill in the context, we know that Jesus had just recently come off a 40-day fast in which he went off in the backside of the desert where no one knew where he was for 40 days. Just in the previous chapter, Jesus will on at least two occasions spend the entire night praying. Jesus now isn't even eating. That may not seem like that big a deal to you, but in the Hebrew culture of the first century, the morning and noon meals were not that important, but the evening meal was almost sacred. In a day long before television, internet, Netflix, the family would gather, and it would be an hour or two-hour meal in which you would gather around and you would talk about the joys and struggles of the day. You would talk about the things you were excited about and those things you were worried about. You would take the time to read the Torah, the Old Testament law, and study it and memorize it and meditate on it. It was an incredibly important time. But Jesus didn't have time for meals. And his family decides that he has lost his mind. And so finally they come and the crowd says, seated around him, tells him, your mother and your brothers are outside looking for you. And what is Jesus' response? Who are my mother and brothers? He asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother. In fairness, as Jesus is hanging on the cross, recognizing that his mother will be all alone as the oldest son and the responsibility falls upon him to provide for her, looks at his disciple John and says, John, make certain she's cared for. Jesus cared for his parents. He cared for his siblings. But he cared more about his Father's will. I understand this is a really tight rope to walk. But I fear sometimes in our focus on the family Christian society, we can put our family above God. And we can spend so much time consumed with our family that we don't do the things that God expects of us. I'm not suggesting you should neglect your family at all. But I think it is good for us to examine what is the most important relationship to me in the world. My wife and kids need to know I love them, but they need to know I love God most. Paul says that we need to be careful that we don't allow family to distract us. He then goes on to say we need to secondly make certain that pain and suffering don't distract us. He says in verse 30, those who mourn as if they did not. Our society is such, Christianity in America is such, if you turn on the television, you go to one of the Christian channels, my very strong suspicion what you're going to find is what is called the prosperity gospel. There is a large popular teaching that suggests that God wants you to be healthy and wealthy. And if you simply spend enough time praying, if you believe enough, no one will ever get sick. No one will ever struggle financially. But is that really true? Paul in 2 Corinthians is going to share with us that three times he's going to plead, God, there's this thorn in my flesh. Please take it away from me. This suffering can't be good. And yet, what is God's response? No, Paul, that suffering is good for you. See, I think in American society, we don't like to suffer. And sometimes we become so scared of pain, we run. Acts chapter 15 has this fascinating story. Paul and Barnabas are commissioned by the church in chapter 13 of Acts. They go out primarily to modern day Turkey and they evangelize and they have a tremendous response. Churches are started, lives are transformed. But Paul is preaching a gospel that is by grace alone, through faith alone, and Christ alone. And some back in Jerusalem are uncomfortable. Don't they have to become Jews? I mean, after all, the Jews are God's people. Shouldn't they be circumcised? Shouldn't they follow the law? And in chapter 15, there's this council called together, and the conclusion is, no, salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, and Christ alone. And Paul and Barnabas decide it's time to go back. And so Paul gathers Barnabas and says, let's go. And Barnabas says, great, let me grab my nephew, John Mark, and we'll go. And Paul says, what? That traitor? He ain't coming with me. You know what happened when we first saw some opposition? He held his tail between his leg and he fled. I can't have somebody, when pain comes, he stops. In fairness, one of the priorities, one of the goals for 2016 is for us as a church to take an adult missions trip. I just wanted to inform you where we're going this summer is to Syria. We're going to the heart of ISIS territory and we're going to be ministering to the Christians who have been displaced by ISIS and we're going to evangelize the Muslims there in ISIS territory. My guess is not many of us are signing up. I don't think that's too dissimilar to what Paul and Barnabas were facing. Read the book of Acts. Paul gets beaten up in every way you can possibly get beaten up. He's in prison time and time again. He's stoned and left for dead. He's shipwrecked. He eventually will lose his head for the cause of Christ. I'm not sure I would be any better than John Mark when pain and suffering becomes a reality of obedience to God. Are you willing to continue? We're told that the division is so intense that Paul grabs Silas and goes west, and he ends up in Philippi and eventually into the city of Corinth. Barnabas, we don't know what happens to Barnabas. He takes John Mark and goes, and Barnabas is lost to history. John Mark isn't. In fact, as Paul concludes the final letter that he would pen, he's in chapter 4 of 2 Timothy writing a number of requests to Timothy, and one of them is, only Luke is with me. Go get Mark and bring him with you because he is helpful to me in the ministry. Tradition says that eventually John Mark will become attached to the Apostle Peter and he will live with Peter. And the second gospel we have is written by this man from the perspective most likely of Peter. Because even though he failed, God forgave. Maybe suffering has scared you. Maybe the looks, the stares, the words of coworkers or friends has gotten you wondering whether or not you should continue. John Mark stands as this incredible reminder that failure need not be final because we serve a forgiving God. But there's not only family and pain. He says those who were happy as if they were not. So Paul says that there are times in which pleasure has a way of deceiving us. I think there are few virtues in America more valued than the desire to enjoy life. But unfortunately, too often, the pursuit of pleasure leads us astray. He then turns, fourthly, to possessions. We spent a year and a half going through the book of Genesis. In the book of Genesis, the classic, I would suggest the main character of the book is a man by the name of Abraham. Paul will use him in the book of Romans as his greatest illustration of what it means to believe, to trust God. But do you remember what he was asked to do? In Genesis 12, God comes to Abraham while he lives in the Ur of Chaldees. Now, my guess is for most of us, Ur doesn't mean anything to us. If you were to put it on a modern map, you would see that it is in modern day Iraq. And if you've watched any of the images from television about what's going on in Iraq, some of us, at least I would say, okay, I wouldn't mind leaving Ur either. It's hot, it's dusty, it's terrible. But in Abraham's day, in the second millennial BC, there was no more advanced society on planet Earth than Ur. Most historians would suggest that Ur was the first civilization that had running water, written text. They were known for their mathematical and scientific advancements. It was a city of approximately 250,000 people, which was an incredible-sized city in the second millennium BC. It was as prosperous a place as you could live. And God comes to Abraham and says, Abraham, I want you to go. No, I'm not telling you where. I just want you to go. If I had a bus parked out in the parking lot this morning, and I said, I believe it is God's will for you to get on the bus, we're going to be driving to the Cedar Rapids Airport, we're getting on an airplane, and we're flying to another country, and we're never coming back to Victor again. No, you don't have time to pack. Leave everything. Would you be willing to go? Hebrews chapter 11, speaking of Abraham, says, by faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. The rest of his life, he became a nomad. The only land Abraham would ever own again was the land he would buy to bury his wife Sarah. Because Abraham was looking forward to a city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. possessions are an incredible gift from God. In fact, I love the way that Paul states it. He doesn't say we shouldn't buy things. We just shouldn't buy them as if we're going to keep them. And yet, I'm afraid we fall in love with our things. I'm guessing I'm not the only one who has found himself thinking, if I only had blank, life would be perfect. See, things have this lure of which they try and convince us that if you have a new house, a new car, a new whatever, your life would be perfect. And you get in it, oftentimes it is enjoyable for a minute, a month, a few months. And it isn't long until you want the next thing. But even if you don't become consumed by things, it always amazes me how much time things take. You buy the perfect house, that 3,000-foot square house that has the 4 bedrooms and the 3 baths, and it's more than sufficient for your entire family, and you enjoy it, and then the kids graduate and they move on, and you're still living in the 3,000-foot house, but now you're only using 3 bedrooms, and then soon 2 bedrooms, and then 1 bedroom. Do you know what? You still got to clean all 4. You only use 1 of the 3 bathrooms, but it's amazing. The other 2 still leak. It's amazing how much time things take. Much simpler would your life be if you just lived in a tent. I'm not suggesting that we sell our houses and buy tents. In fact, Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6 is going to say that God has given us all of these possessions for our enjoyment, as long as we receive them with gratitude and continue to worship our God. Things can become this incredible distraction. But there's one final one, and Paul is going to say in verse 31, those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them. It seems as if what Paul is trying to allude to is that not only do we get distracted by family, by pain, by possessions, by pleasure, but there is this desire to be in charge, to do things that will benefit, will promote yourself. And Paul is saying that if God gives you the privilege of being in a position of leadership, make certain that you're not consumed by that power. My guess is you've all heard this statement, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. If I can go back to Hebrews chapter 11, there's this amazing illustration of Moses. My Sunday school class for the last 2 months have been going through the life of Moses, and we get so enamored by this man who becomes maybe the greatest man in Israel's history. One of the people that God will use in amazing ways. See, he's one of the few people in the history of humanity that can honestly say, I saw God. He has a chance to go to the mountaintop and talk to God. He has the chance to be used to bring these 10 plagues, to bring the greatest nation on the planet to its knees. Moses is used in an amazing way. But don't forget how it starts. Moses is taken by Pharaoh's daughter, and he's brought into the palace of Egypt, the most prosperous, the most powerful planet on earth. And for 40 years, Moses lives with Pharaoh. I don't know, some have speculated that Moses may very well have been the next in line to be Pharaoh. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that he was in a position where he had everything a person could ever want. But one day he had to choose. Will I hang on to the things? Will I hang on to the pleasures? Will I hang on to the influence and power that I have? Or will I leave it all to go live on the backside of the desert? Will I leave it all to go and suffer, to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoying the fleeting pleasures of sin? Moses left it all. And had you talked to Moses, my guess is most of us would have counseled him, Moses, you're an idiot. How can you leave this position? Just think of the amazing influence that God could use you right here in the palace of Pharaoh. And Moses said, but that's not what God wants for me. And he leaves and he cares for sheep for 40 years, and then God brings him back and uses Moses in amazing ways. I don't know if you remember comments that the pastor you had when you were growing up said, but I can still remember the pastor that I sat under most of my childhood would oftentimes ask this question: how many here have ever heard of Amenhotep IV? My guess is not very many of us. But that was the next pharaoh by many scholars' accounts. But I would suggest there's not a place on earth you can go where the name of Moses hasn't been heard. Moses is known almost the world round. Why? Because he made the hardest decision anyone will ever make. I'm going to leave it all and follow God. I don't think too many of us here this morning are in line to become the next pharaoh, the next president, the next king. But I wonder, is God more important to me than anyone or anything or any opportunity? See, I would suggest what Paul is arguing is that you and I need to be careful to avoid the distractions of life and to be completely and utterly devoted to Christ. You just ask, what is distracting you this morning? Father, I thank you for Paul. I thank you for this amazing man of God who was willing to endure incredible pain, suffering, so that he could have the chance to serve you. God, I do pray that whatever our distractions are, that you might help us to live a life wholly and completely devoted to you. God, I pray this week as we go back to our lives, as it were, that we might continue to serve you completely. Thank you. For it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen.